Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
The bill is passed without objection. A motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
Next stop, the Senate. The U.S. House of Representatives approves billions in foreign aid for Ukraine, ending a months-long political deadlock. Welcome to Your World Tonight. I'm Ithil Moussa. Also on the podcast, a major soccer tournament promises to give Germany a major tourism boost. But more people means more problems. We'll tell you how that country is beefing up security. And later, an ancient game is attracting a young fan base.
I'm waiting for Pragnananda, Feruza, Alexandra, and Tan.
International chess superstars are going head-to-head in Toronto. Kyiv finally has the answer it's waited months for, one that Ukraine's president says will save tens of thousands of lives. After fraught negotiations and delays, the U.S. House of Representatives today approved $61 billion of military aid. It is all but guaranteed to pass the Senate and make its way to the president's desk. Sasha Petrasik reports.
On this vote, the ayes are 311 and the nays are 112. The bill is passed.
With cheers and lots of Ukrainian flag waving, Democrat and Republican lawmakers overwhelmingly supported $61 billion U.S. in aid to Kyiv, the most contentious part of a complicated package of bills that sparked much drama and took months to pass the House of Representatives.
If we turn our backs right now, the consequences could be devastating.
Pushed through by embattled Republican Speaker Mike Johnson, who was still arguing with some in his own party after the vote about what's at stake.
It's a dangerous time. Three of our primary adversaries, Russia and Iran and China, are working together, and they're being aggressors around the globe.
The bills also include $8 billion for Taiwan and $26 billion for Israel, whose support rose here this week after it was targeted by Iran. For Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, this is a lifeline which he immediately acknowledged with "Thank you, America." I thank all American hearts who, like us, feel that Russian evil must not win, he says. In recent weeks, the prospect of a Russian military victory seemed more likely as Ukraine ran low on ammunition and struggled to repel Russian drones and missiles, Zelensky pleading with Washington for the kind of defensive weapons Israel has.
We are telling this directly to defend. We need 7 more Patriots or similar air defense systems, and it's a minimum number.
But U.S. lawmakers dragged out debate in a House narrowly controlled by Republicans, bogged down by a split among them. Supporters of Donald Trump, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who calls today's vote a sellout.
When we had members of Congress in there waving the Ukrainian flag on the United States House of Representatives floor, while we're doing nothing to secure our border, I think every American in this country should be furious.
She's part of a Republican faction trying to oust Johnson, who succeeded in rallying conservative hawks like Colorado's Doug Lamborn for the vote to pass.
Our standing in the world is at stake.
The bills now go to the Senate, where majority Democrats are likely to pass them quickly. The White House says it's ready to ship Ukraine's military hardware right away. Sasha Petrasik, CBC News, Washington.
As Sasha mentioned, the U.S. House is pledging $26 billion for Israel, about one-third of which is for people in need of humanitarian aid, including in Gaza. Officials from the territory's health ministry says an Israeli airstrike on Friday killed at least 9 people. The conflict has led to a dramatic escalation of tensions in the Middle East, with Israel and Iran launching tit-for-tat strikes against one another. Sarah McMillan has more.
Bodies covered in white sheets are transported on stretchers outside a hospital in Rafah. Hospital officials say most of the victims in this latest airstrike are children. A man surveys rubble as people collect belongings from destroyed buildings. "We are civilians," he says. "How can they bomb us like this?" This latest attack comes in a week where many in the region have been watching Israel and Iran and the mounting tensions between those countries, with a series of airstrikes threatening to engulf the Middle East in a wider regional war. Yesterday, Iran played down an apparent Israeli airstrike near a major airbase and nuclear site, indicating they were pulling back from what could have been an all-out conflict. Meanwhile, in Iraq, authorities are investigating an explosion there.
Things don't ever stay quiet.
Sajin Gohel is the International Security Director at the Asia-Pacific Foundation. He says there seems to be a moment of calm between Israel and Iran, but says history shows that likely won't last.
Each side seems to want to stoke up tensions, be seen to not lose face, not lose their own ability to operate militarily, and also to have a deterrence.
But with the countries appearing to pull back for now, attention is again turning to Rafah. The city is the last refuge for displaced Palestinians in Gaza, with more than half of the enclave's population of about 2.3 million now sheltering there. Earlier this month, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said a date was set for a ground operation in Rafah.
There's a sort of been an eerie silence on that. We have to watch this space to see whether they go through with that or not.
The U.S. and other allies have urged restraint, saying that a wide-scale Israeli military operation in Rafah could make an already dire humanitarian crisis much worse. Sarah McMillan, CBC News, Toronto.
A prominent British Palestinian doctor has been denied entry into Germany. He was set to speak at a pro-Palestinian conference, which was shut down by police. It's the latest example of how Germany is struggling to balance the right to free speech with its historic support for Israel. Rebecca Collard in Berlin has more.
I was asked what I was doing in Germany. I told them that I'm here attending a congress.
Dr. Rassan Abu Sitta recounts his arrival in Berlin this month. The British-Palestinian doctor was meant to be the keynote speaker at the Palestina Congress, a three-day conference in the German capital. The surgeon had spent more than 40 days in Gaza, helping the injured and speaking almost daily to international media.
But as a witness to the crimes happening in Gaza, I've been asked by the Congress organizers to give my evidence to what I had seen at Shifa and at Al-Ahli hospitals.
A German government spokesperson told CBC News they could not comment on why Abu Sitta was denied entry to the country, citing data protection reasons. The conference organizers and activists say it's a sign of growing repression here of any criticism of the war in Gaza or German policy toward Israel. As Abu Sitta was being held in the Berlin airport, German police shut down the conference he was meant to attend. Organizers say when they arrived at the venue, they were met by hundreds of German police officers. Videos posted online show police carrying a well-known Jewish Israeli activist in a watermelon kippah out of the conference.
A Jewish person, and then you're talking about
according to a government spokesperson, the conference was shut down because of Islamist propaganda and hatred towards Jews. But Matt de Vlieger, another Jewish activist detained by police at the conference, disagrees.
Germany and German power is going to call anything they don't like anti-Semitic. They've been calling Jews anti-Semitic. Jews have been disproportionately canceled in this country over the last months. And they've used the term anti-Semitism against everything that they don't like.
Dr. Rassan Abu Sitta says at the end of his interrogation in Berlin, he was told not only was he banned from entering Germany until the end of April,
that they threatened that even if I tried to speak through Zoom in Germany during that period, or send a recorded video to Germany from somewhere else, that I would be breaching German law with the risk of a fine or a year's imprisonment.
And he is not alone. Former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis was also supposed to speak at the event and was informed he was banned from making any political speeches in Germany.
Of the Federal Republic of Germany, burst in and prevented Jews, Palestinians, and the rest of us who wanted to have a Congress during which to discuss peace, reconciliation, coexistence, universal human rights.
And like Abu Sitta, Varoufakis was told he's not even allowed to speak by video call to Germany or send pre-recorded speeches from outside the country. Rebecca Collard for CBC News, Berlin.
Many young Canadians say home ownership is simply unattainable, and some experts agree.
We have allowed the dream that a good home should be in reach for what hard work can earn. We've allowed that dream to really slip away.
Coming up, we'll explore the federal government's budget promise to help move young Canadians out of rentals and into the home buying market. Millions of soccer fans will be flocking to Germany in June for the 2024 UEFA European Football Championship. One of the sport's biggest events, the Euros, will pit the continent's best teams against one another. Nearly 3 million people are expected to attend, with millions more visiting just to soak up the atmosphere. But as Lauren Sprawl in London reports, the huge numbers are also bringing increasing security and safety concerns.
Insubordinate, insolent, and intoxicated. Thousands of England soccer fans knocking over boundaries and hurtling past security guards in neon yellow vests. These were the scenes at Wembley Stadium in London just before the final match of Euro 2020. Scenes the organizers of this year's Euros are keen to avoid. Germany's interior minister told members of the press last month that the host nation would work tirelessly to ensure Euro 2024 would be a peaceful, memorable event, which might be easier said than done.
Ultimately, what you're dealing with is, you know, largely a bunch of drunken men transporting themselves around a country.
The Euros are expected to welcome as many as 12 million people just to soak up the atmosphere. Analyst Martin Lodge says there is an inevitable risk of violence when that many football fans are in attendance.
Hello everybody, welcome to the World Cup final of 2006.
The last event of this magnitude Germany hosted was the 2006 World Cup, which Lodge says left little to improve upon.
In many ways, this was such a successful event. The problem is it went too well. In that sense, there was very little crowd violence. Everyone was happy. So it seems like a very different world from the present one.
The pandemic, economic instability, and the rise of populist, sometimes extreme politics in Europe continues to divide society, according to analysts. Some also blame these trends on an uptick in soccer-related violence. Data released from the UK's Home Office last year showed the number of arrests at football matches in England and Wales was the highest it's been in 9 years. But the behavior of fans at the Euros is not the only thing keeping organizers on high alert.
The bomb, which was loaded onto a van...
Major sporting events have long been a common target for terror attacks. A bomb planted by the IRA during the 1996 Euros destroyed a shopping center in Manchester, although luckily no one was killed. As part of the coordinated terror attack on Paris in 2015, a suicide bomber was stopped as he tried to enter the Stade de France during an exhibition match between France and Germany, but not before the bomb detonated, killing one passerby.
Of course, the terrorism threat has changed.
David Hawley worked as a security advisor for the BBC during the 2006 World Cup.
Terrorist groups now operating in Europe. They have sleeper cells. They obviously hit Moscow recently and have hit all over Europe in the last few years. So it is a much higher, more visible threat this time round.
He says the main challenge with preparing for these kinds of mega events is how spread out everyone is.
There's going to be so many targets. It's not just the stadium. There are going to be thousands of fans in fan zones, market squares, wherever there's an open cafe or pub.
Germany has announced temporary border controls for the duration of the tournament. the interior minister says this is to prevent possible perpetrators of violence from entering the country. Lauren Sproul, CBC News, London.
A New Brunswick man who spent decades trying to clear his name after a wrongful conviction has died. Last month, we brought you the story of Walter Gillespie. He and his friend, Robert Mailman, were convicted in the 1983 murder of a man in St. John. Gillespie spent 21 years in prison. The two men got a new trial last December, and in early January, they were acquitted of all charges. Gillespie died Friday at his home in St. John. He was 80 years old. The federal government's budget is promising fairness for every generation, and two in particular are being targeted. The Liberals laid out a plan to help boost housing supply and make home ownership a reality for young Canadians. Evan Dyer looks into that for us tonight.
The economy doesn't seem fair to young adults.
This week's budget rolled out with a new focus, no longer the middle class and those working to join it, but millennials and Gen Z.
That demographic, in all honesty, we need to beg their forgiveness.
Paul Kershaw is a professor at the University of British Columbia's School of Population and Public Health and founder of the group Generation Squeeze.
We have allowed the dream that a good home should be in reach for what hard work can earn. We've allowed that dream to really slip away.
The problems have been accumulating for decades, says Kershaw.
Under Prime Minister Harper, average home prices went up 60%, according to the Canadian Real Estate Association. Under Prime Minister Trudeau, they've gone up another 54%.
Kershaw says a whole generation has benefited, even as the young have lost ground.
I live in Metro Vancouver, and I've gained about $1.5 million wealth in the last 20 years. Well, I've been watching TV, cleaning in the kitchen, and sleeping. And that's come at the expense of a younger person being able to be just as smart as me, just as hardworking as me, but now can't live where I do.
But Kershaw says housing is only one of the ways in which the baby boom generation picked the best fruits of the economy and left behind mostly scraps or even a cleanup bill for those who followed after. He calls it over-extraction. And it can also be seen in the legacy of environmental damage and climate change, which surveys show have left younger Canadians pessimistic for the future. It can also be seen in fiscal overextraction, the way in which the boomers used their numbers and voting power to prioritize their own needs.
And typically governments come in and one of the roles of government is to try and smooth over differences that generations face simply because of when they were born.
Robin Bodway is an economist at Queen's University in Kingston. He says during two world wars and a depression, governments used borrowing to spread heavy burdens over time.
Governments are also building up debt for reasons that have nothing to do with spreading burdens across generations, but have more to do with providing current services to existing generations.
The budget goes some way to help the young, the economists say, but old age security spending has its own momentum and will continue to grow much faster than other programs.
These problems have their source in failures of planning decades ago.
Kershaw says that by 2028, for every new federal dollar spent on the environment, housing, defense, childcare, and healthcare for people under 45 combined, nearly three new dollars will go to old age security, healthcare for over 65s, and debt servicing. Nothing any government can do will change the demographic fact that there are more old people than ever before. That reality is here to stay, say economists, and government will need to shift their priorities or face more disillusionment from the young. Evan Dyer, CBC News, Ottawa.
A centuries-old strategy game is growing in popularity among young people. The prestigious Candidates Chess Tournament is happening in Toronto. It's the first time the tournament has been held in North America. Hayden Waters spoke to some young fans and brings us this report.
A group of kids are swarming in front of a concert hall in downtown Toronto. Eduardo is campus, and his sister April flew from Calgary to be here. Both are eager to get autographs, but it's not rock stars they are waiting for.
I'm waiting for Pragnananda, Ferusa, Alexandra, and Tan.
Eduardo is rhyming off a list of the best chess players in the world. They've been in Toronto for the past few weeks competing in the Candidates Tournament. If you follow chess, you know it's a huge deal. Players and media are here from around the world. Arya Antari is a chess grandmaster visiting from Norway.
This is like the most prestigious tournament in the chess world. The winner here plays the world championship match. It's really, really prestigious.
Okay, now it's time for a play to start. So players, start your clocks and enjoy your round.
Russian chess whiz Jan Nepomniachtchi has won the last two candidates tournaments. He's here again, eyeing a third victory. But many are excited by the prospect of a new, younger winner, like 17-year-old phenom Gukesh D. Anna Bertasova is helping run the event. She's also a grandmaster who moved from Russia to Toronto.
I think this change of generations, these new young players coming in, they're helping to keep this tournament more lively, let's say, with more interesting games. And we can see every day we have a lot of decisive results. So it's not just draws, and it's amazing chess.
And there's no e5 then.
E5, you take on d4, and take on c2.
Ah.
Okay, and then that
position. Bertasova works with the Annex Chess Club in Toronto. Over the past few years, she has seen the game take off. She credits the boom in internet chess during the pandemic, and of course the Netflix show, The Queen's Gambit. It's all helped introduce a new generation. As the games drag into their fourth hour, Eduardo Escampos continues to patiently wait out front. He dreams of competing one day too.
I hope that I can have the same level that them because I love chess and I want to be like them.
Hayden Waters, CBC News, Toronto.
Under the bright lights of New York Times Square, a Nigerian chess master has broken the record for the longest chess marathon. It happened at about 12:40 a.m. Eastern this morning. Tunde Onakoya played chess nonstop for 60 hours to break the Guinness World Record. The 29-year-old is hoping to raise $1 million for children's education across Africa. The Guinness World Record Organization has yet to publicly comment about Onakoya's attempt. Among the dozens who cheered him on at the scene was Nigerian music star Davido. We'll leave you with the song Unavailable off his 2023 album Timeless. This has been Your World Tonight for April 20th, 2024. I'm Ethel Musa. Good night.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.